We are in Revelation 13. And to recap, the last time we talked would have been, we started with verse 11. And I'm just going to read from there. We'll pick back up kind of where we were. But it says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb that spoke, and a spoke, and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth to, and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that even he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both great or both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666 or 666 or however we want to word that." Now, a couple things that I did talk about with that, we did cover a lot, but I do want to still go back over a couple things. One is that this is a different... You had the beast that came from the sea. Now this one's coming up from the earth. And the conversation I've talked about with a couple of folks through this is that, those that did not honor the first beast were put to death. And so the second beast almost seems... The more I've studied it this week and looked over some things, the more I've thought that this... You've got the beast... who comes from the sea, who would be like the Antichrist. And then this second beast would almost be like the false prophet, as we kind of discussed before. But this beast's sole purpose is to bring attention to the first beast. And in the process of that, what we see is that there's this whole attitude that kind of goes around with it. And in the midst of all of this, it tells you enough about that. But he had two horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon. And so what we're seeing here is that it kind of calls us back to this beast is a deceiver. It's almost the combination of a lion and a lamb together. In some ways, you've got the lamb, which we would always translate mentally as soft and easy and gentle. Gentle as a lamb, and then speaks like a dragon. So you're seeing something. If we metaphorically look at this conversation, and these are not things that I talked about the last time we met, this is... If we metaphorically look at this, you've got something that is gentle, easy on the eyes, and the moment that you buy in, it's deceptive in that it speaks like a dragon. And what does it mean to speak like a dragon? Well, it means that it burns. I guess, I don't know. I'm that's a difficult thing, but it brings to mind kind of this image of a fire-breathing mythical dragon that we always talk about. I don't know that that's the mythical part is anything that John would have been messing with, though, because they would have... The fact that the Bible talks about dragons, it leads you to believe that dinosaurs and man, or dragons and man, existed at the same time, for the simple purpose that if we think about it, I mean, we all went to the Arkansas, the Creation Museum, and everything that goes with that. But if you think about it, there's really no question in my mind, how would they know what a dragon is? Why would they talk about it scripturally as examples of things if people didn't know what they were? if people didn't kind of understand what they were. So what does that mean for us? Well, the passage kind of recalls us back to the warning that Jesus gave in Matthew 7:15. And I'm going to go back and read that again just real quickly. But then we're going to move on. But in Matthew 7:15, it says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." In other words, Jesus gave that warning, and he gives the warning of this gentle, harmless sheep that has that speaks like a dragon, that inside is a ravenous wolf. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing, in essence. And so as we look at this, the fact that this beast speaks like a dragon could either mean that he spoke with the roar of a dragon or as the serpent in maybe the Garden of Eden, which was deceptive. It was beguiling. It was convincing. Convinced Adam and Eve to eat from the tree. So that could be what this statement is. Or it could be that it's loud, boisterous, and it's going to be heard. I mean, any image you ever see of a dragon is an image where the dragon's louder than anything around it. It gets the attention of those around. But if we go back into just thinking of the dragon itself as a serpent or any reptilian, you know, we know the serpent in the Garden of Eden spoke to Eve convincingly, cunningly, slyly to convince her to eat of that tree. I don't think that he was screaming it to the top of his lungs, because why would he? Had Eve not already eaten of the fruit, Adam wouldn't have partaken. And, you know, I mean, I can't say that for sure, but I can simply say that he approached Eve and spoke silently as to not be caught while doing it. So there's this deceptive nature of the beast, this deceptive nature of this situation. And the role of the second beast is solely to bring attention to the first. That's what we were talking about. And what we see here is that it pretty much says he was granted power to breathe to the image, to give breath to the image of the beast. He not only was it to bring attention, but it was to cause men to build statues to the beast, cause men to build shrines and paint pictures and do these things. And when that takes place, he then gives voice to the beast. This is where I got into the conversation of the way that life pretty much is carried out here, and we're seeing that this is basically a beast that appears to be a Christ-like figure. Then we get into verses 13 through 15, where it talks about the performance of signs and miracles. Deuteronomy 13 warns us about false prophets and worshiping other gods by means of signs and wonders. The second beast imitates the miracles of the prophets to further bring attention to the first beast, to further give a leg to stand on, so to speak, to the Antichrist. The false prophet gives people a reason to believe, you know, by the signs and wonders that he's performing, he brings attention to the first beast. You've got these shrines, these statues, these things that are built to the first beast that are now given voice. And so what we see here is that the second beast imitates the miracles of the true prophets and deceive people. I don't know that I focused on that too much, but it even tells us what some of those are. He was given power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image should both speak and cause many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Then in the conversation right before that, it does also say he performs signs and wonders, and he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. That's a throwback to Elijah. It's also a throwback to the two witnesses that we've already spoken of. The two witnesses, a few chapters earlier, you've got the two witnesses who were bringing attention to God, who were performing these signs and wonders, and the things that Moses and Elijah would have done on the earth, the things that were taking place, we see that in the two witnesses. Well, now we've got two beasts that are doing the same wonders and signs that are coming after the whole situation. So basically saying that he calls down fire from heaven, this would be a false Elijah. We've already seen, you know, John the Baptist was also called Elijah in a couple of texts. So Elijah would have been the voice in the wilderness that's crying out, prepare you the way of the Lord. So this would be a false Elijah. He's crying out, prepare the way of the Lord, or the beast. I mean, he may not call it the beast, but he's preparing the way for the other. And so as we see this, the false prophet given power to do all these things, it gets us down into the end of verse 15 and into 16, 17, and 18, which is where we were when we finished up. And what we see is that in the midst of this, what began as following the beast inevitably led to worshiping the beast. This is where the conversation can really turn and where we can start to think, okay, what exactly is this about? Is this beast an actual beast on the earth? Or is it metaphorical for something else? If we look at some of the history of the world and the way that things happen, and even going into some of the texts that we talked about this morning, men deceptively put man first. They think about themselves. They think about, you know, their plans versus God's plans. When we start to think about that and we start to really break some of this down, we get into a point where right here we can see that there's a little bit of let me back up for a second. Okay. When the beast makes an appearance, you have things built in the form of the beast. You have things that are created that then are given life in the same way that man was created. Except there's a major difference. God fashioned man out of his own hand. He formed man with his own hands and breathed his life into them. The false prophet is convincing man to build images of the beast and then breathing life into those man-made images. So that being the case, it brings up the question of what is the beast? Does that make sense?
Could the first beast be like a false Antichrist and this one be?
Well, that's what the...
The second beast would be Antichrist because it wants you to follow it?
Well, the second beast is only bringing attention to the first. So the second one actually is alluded to as a false prophet later in Revelation. So it would be like Elijah to God or John the Baptist to Christ. Like he's preparing the way for the Antichrist. The first beast would come across as the Antichrist. And the reason is because there's a number for the beast, not for the beast that he's bringing attention to. The first number is, or the number that's given is actually alluding back to the first beast that came from the sea. The question of whether it's a situation like that, I think what we're looking at here is it a physical beast or a metaphorical beast? And the reason I bring that up and ask that question, and to kind of go along with where you're going, this one is definitely, both are evil. Both are not doing what, they're calling attention to something. And they're doing what God did, but they're doing it backwards. They're doing it in a twisted way. Like I said, God created man with his own hands. The beast, this second beast, the false prophet, is causing man to build images to the first beast. And then giving them life. In a way, but it's all about magic and deception. It's all about smoke and mirrors. It's all about some of these different type things. I think the hard part for me in this to not separate myself from is that what things do we have in the world today? Everything that's man-made becomes a distraction. The television, material things, all of these things that we work our whole lives to distract us from the message that the Lord has for us. They deter us. So any kind of false prophet can be a false prophet that leads us down that road. So much as, you know, there's so many different things that we could look at in this. Now, I'm not at all trying to say that that is definitely what the first beast is that all these different things, but it is that they are man-made images that are given life. The television is a man-made box that's given life. But I'm as guilty as anybody of watching it, so I can't really say anything of anybody. You know, it's, this is something that kind of came up through the week, and I don't necessarily think that it's the watching TV that's the problem. It's the programs we choose to watch that are being made that are giving life to that beast. Because it's an image that moves and it breathes and it speaks. And it's sly and it's deceptive and it's destroying our families. It's destroying us in our core. We think we're okay watching certain things. Movies. There's certain movies. There's a rating system for a reason. You know? And sometimes we get so wrapped up in some of these movies that are probably not. And again, I'm as guilty as anyone of putting myself into those situations, but are they giving life to a beast that we've yet to understand? Are we seeing some things play out in front of us and we're thinking, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't. I mean, have you ever walked out of a movie thinking I should have never seen that? Or stopped watching one on TV that you like, I probably shouldn't have started that. That show was awful. I can't believe they're saying. But by that point, they've drawn you in. Because the next week, then you watch it because you want to see, well, let's see how much worse it'll get. And then 6 weeks later, oh, wow, this is a really good series. And you start recommending it to people.
It's like soap operas.
Yeah. You watch a soap opera the first time, and you walk away from it, and you never watch one again, you know how dumb they are. And if you've ever watched, if you watch one every 20 years, you're going to see the same story. They just recycle the stories, right? I don't know. I don't watch them. That's what I heard my grandma say all the time.
I don't watch them anymore. I used to.
She told me that, what was it, Days of Our Lives? I went in to visit her one day, yeah. And Days of Our Lives was on. It was like Stefano or whatever his name was. She was like, he has died 7 times on this show. I was like, what does he do, die every year? She's like, they keep bringing him back. I was like, but I mean, it's, you know, but she had to watch her pictures. You know, but those are the things that I think we got to understand. I'm not calling the TV the Antichrist. I'm not saying that there aren't good things out there that we can utilize, that God has given man the ability to create to further his kingdom. But what has been used to further God's kingdom has also been used by the enemy to destroy it. I mean, television at its core is not a bad thing if you're watching wholesome programming. But if you're watching things that are throwing shade on God's people and you're giving life to those things, then eventually we start to hear ideas. Why is the church in the state that it's in today? Why is the world in the state that it's in today? It's because we've allowed these ideas that have hit mainstream news media to become ideas that really sit with us. Well, we can't. That's not love. That love wins. This is love. This is that. And then all of a sudden, we look back and go, why did I ever start believing that in the first place? And we've forgotten our first love, which is Christ and the scripture and God's word and learning who he is through his word and getting into it. And so I say all that to say this, that half-hearted Christians And I think this is the last, one of the last things I said. Half-hearted Christians who do not surrender their lives for a cause of Christ and a cause that basically it pulls them to a situation where they're susceptible to the Antichrist. They're susceptible to this situation because they have pulled themselves out of it by not fully committing. This is why in Revelation 3, he says, because you were lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. Why would he have the need to say that? Well, you got somebody sitting on a fence who doesn't want to believe that it goes this way or that way. And because of that, they don't go the right way. Because if you're not going the right way, if you're not fully committed to the right way, then you're outside. There is no fence to ride. It's either you're in the door or out the door, but the door's closed and you're either in or out. And once that door is closed, there's no getting in. It has to be open to you. In the same way that the door has to be open to Christ to come into our heart, the same thing is true. There, you know, it's got to be open from the inside. If you want to come in and dine with Christ, you can't open the door, let Christ in, then run out and sit on the fence and just go back and forth. There's no handle to get you back in. He has to open that door to you. And when he does, you come in and you dine with him. Same thing with you opening the door to him. He knocks and behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone would open the door, and I will come in and dine with him and he with me. But there's that behold, I stand at the door and knock. That implies I'm not going to open it myself. You can yell it's unlocked all you want. I'm not coming in unless you physically open the door and commit to me entering. And that's kind of the image we get here, which then takes us into verse 16, which kind of catches us up to where we were. And in verse 16, it says he causes all, both great, both small, great, rich, poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Verse 17 then says, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So that being said, before you get too scared, think about this. A few chapters earlier, what happened? God's people were sealed and protected, and they received the mark of Christ. Therefore, there's nothing for us to worry about with this situation. That is, unless we have it all wrong as to the timeline of how this works, which is possible. But God's people have been sealed as a sign of his protection in chapter 7. So because of that, the second beast requires all people to receive a mark of him. The reason being is because, as we've already shown through this, there's a very vast similarity to the beast and his actions to what the Lord has already done. He wants to look the part. He wants to look exactly like the Lord. He wants to have that power. Well, how do you get that power? You mark yours. You seal them with your mark. And so that's kind of what he's done. And he's marking them. The second beast is requiring the mark of the first beast on everyone, which is the false prophet and the Antichrist. There have been many speculations regarding what constitutes the mark, tattoo, clothing, jewelry, whatever. One of the more recent ones is a cell phone, which makes really good sense because it says on the forehead and on the wrist, and or on the hand and on the wrist, right? On the hand or on their foreheads. Well, your phone's in your hand or attached to your head. or these little watches are now your phone on your wrist, which is basically putting it right on your hand because you're looking at your hand every time to see it. Now, does that mean that cell phones are evil? No, they're not the Antichrist. They have no life. They are given life. There was even an argument that Apple only was the mark of the beast. The rest of them wasn't because you got the fruit. I'm like, whatever. I'm not going to get into that argument either. What I will say, however, is this. Whatever the mark may be, it deliberately contrasts with the marked foreheads of the Lamb's people. It will deliberately be the exact opposite. This is why a lot of times you'll see the goat that this is why Satan worshipers adopted a goat as a symbol of the religion. Why you see a lot of satanic stuff that deals with a goat head, because it's in direct violation with what the image of Christ is, and that is a lamb. The sheep from the goats. You've got the sheep, the goats, and so they use the goat. They call themselves, they adopt that upon themselves. It's directly the opposite. I mean, it will be obvious what the mark of the beast is. So I don't think it's something we have to go, well, what if it's this? Well, what if it's that? I don't believe it's Monster Energy for a lot of reasons. I mean, and I can show you. Everybody talks about this right here. The Hebrew 666 is what they want to argue. Yes, that is a 6 in Hebrew. But if you're writing out a number in Hebrew, that is not 666. It would look completely different. That being said, I get what they're saying and some of the things as well. So, I mean, you know, but it's all distractions. It's all things to draw our attention from what really might be taking place. So we need to be careful. Verse 14, or chapter 14, verse 1, I'm going to read for a reason, because it answers a little bit of this here in verse 16. In verse 16 of chapter 13, it says, he causes all, both great, both small, great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. That being said, verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1 says, then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. The sealed. The 144,000 who were sealed show back up here in chapter 14. We're not quite there yet, but they show back up in verse 1, and they have a mark. And that mark is his name on their forehead. He has written his name. What it is the best description I've ever heard of this, I think, is what did Bob Ross do at the end of every show? He signed his artwork, right? He wrote Ross on the bottom. And if you bought an artwork that said Ross on the bottom, it's worth something now. Well, we're God's masterpiece. We're his handiwork. We were created by him, painted by him. And at the end, he seals us with his name. He seals his work with his name on their forehead. That's a beautiful image to me. Now, is that truly what happens? No, I don't know. It says he seals them on the forehead. It says they're marked with his name. And it says the beast does the same thing with a number or a name or a name that would be, or a number that correlates to a name. But even more so, one of the things that we'll get into here in a minute, but this mark is only used to show loyalty. It's used to show loyalty to the beast, but not only that, it becomes your currency on the earth. Those that are marked with God's name will not have any, or if you don't have the mark of the beast, you are not allowed to buy, sell, and trade. You're not allowed to do anything. If you do not bear the mark that this second that the false prophet is wanting you to grab and take, then you cannot live. If they didn't kill you for not taking it, they keep you from eating, they keep you from doing anything. You're basically put into a prison in your own life where you're out and free, but you can't do anything. You can't buy, you can't sell, you can't trade, you can't do anything. Because you don't bear the currency. You don't bear the mark of the government or the beast or whatever it might be. And only those with that mark will be allowed to buy and sell. Only those with the mark. Now, I didn't put this in my notes, but before I go to verse 18, which should wrap us up and kind of be a little bit of a recap, I do want to say this, though. There's something about verse 16 that also should catch your attention, and that is this. It's not just for a select group of people. Exactly. The same way that God's Spirit works. The same way that God's sacrifice worked. Everything about what the beast is doing through the false prophet is about becoming God to the people on earth. Oh, well, your God did this for everybody. Well, our God doesn't show anything. There's no definition between rich and poor, little or big, free or slave. I mean, think about the ministry that we heard over and over and over again from the apostles. As you look through the New Testament and the words that they say about Christ and his sacrifice and who it's for, there's no, you know, and what does he say? There's no Jew nor Greek. There's all of these lists where it's saying there's not man or woman, there's not this, there's not that. Everyone is equal in the eyes of the Lord. It's the same imagery that you have here in verse 16. And then verse 16 takes us into 17, where you can't buy or sell. And then verse 18, this is probably one of my favorite verses of all of this. And the reason being, not because it has a number on it, not because we find out something interesting. It starts with the words, here is wisdom. Here is wisdom. In other words, he's kind of backed up from everything he's writing here. And he's saying, you would be wise to know this. You would be wise to understand what I'm about to say. And then he says, let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. His number is 666. Now, this is where the conversations can turn. But no verse in Revelation has received more attention than this one with a reference to the number of the beast. I didn't dive into this too much. I only read a couple of little things from my notes about this when we talked, but I had to get it out that night, you know. But this is the most important text in the Bible that depends on understanding the ancient practice of gematria. And gematria is something that was used by Jews and by other civilizations. It's found special meaning in words and names adding up to the numerical value of their letters. So the numerical value of the letters that are there, letters of the alphabet often served as numbers. And so the first nine letters stood for the numbers 1 through 9, the next nine for the numbers 10 through 90, and so on. So, like, if we took our alphabet, the first nine letters would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, which would be J through J, which means that K and the next nine would be 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And that would take us up to 18. There's 26, so the next ones would be hundreds, and so on. Like if we had an out, but that's how they added this up. That's how it would have added up. Well, in their alphabet, this is what would have been seen. So it served as a precaution against the charge of sedition by avoiding the naming of a specific person, such as the emperor. The number 666 or 666 correlated with one name in first century Rome, according to many scholars. And that one name was Nero. That name added up to 666. I think that it was another, I can't remember how it adds up, but there's a way that it adds up. But anyway, it served as a precaution against the charge of sedition by avoiding naming the specific person, but the beast number was 666 or 666, however we want to look at it. By the second century, the solution to the riddle had escaped all but maybe some of the most prominent theologians. I don't know what the number stood for. I mean, we don't practice this anymore in our in our language today. You know, I gave you that example so we maybe understand what maybe took place. But the best answer, I think, you know, there's Nero is a name that was thrown about because Nero would have fulfilled that based on some of the numerology type things that people were coming up with. And this I can't pronounce it without looking at it. Gematria. When we look at this now, I think that even recent suggestions aren't really convincing to me as that is who he was talking about. There's plenty of names that we could throw about, and there's plenty of ways we could make it work, no matter who it would be. I mean, how many times have you heard, well, he's the Antichrist? It's got to be the Antichrist. There's no explanation for it. Hitler in the 1940s, everybody thought Hitler was the Antichrist.
But don't their name have to have six letters in first name, six letters in middle name, and six letters in the...
No. I mean, I don't...
That's what I was, I've heard for years.
All it gives us is that the number is 666, and that's another suggestion that people have come up with, saying, well, it's three names, 666, and I can think of one that in recent terms fit that exact mold, and that's possibly where an argument came from. And I'll tell you as soon as the recording's off, because I'm not getting into that whole debate. But what I see is there is one name recently, like real recently, that fits. But the best answer for us, and I think I did talk about this, the best answer I think that we can give this is not to cryptologically look at it in any other way than to look at this and think of it more as the number that the Bible uses to describe perfection throughout is what? Even those that heard my answer can answer. Last time. Y'all have forgotten too? There you go. Seven. The number seven is typically interpreted as perfection or completion, which means that 777 would indicate perfectly round, perfectly complete, perfectly. It would have been perfection as in the Trinity of God. Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, 777. It would have been perfection within that. And so, in other words, 666 could just simply represent that it falls short. All of these things are happening. It's perfectly happening, but there's something about it that's just not perfect. He's able to do the same signs and wonders. He's able to get a following. He's able to mark them. But there's no life beyond that. There's nothing in it that can lead you. So it's a number that falls short of perfection in each digit. So as we look at that, then one writer actually says that it represents failure upon failure upon failure. And so it's a symbolic situation about how the beast continuing failure to accomplish the purpose that he was trying to, I mean, He continues to fail, but he continues to try. Christ on the cross. Well, let's go back to Garden of Eden. Garden of Eden, he convinced man to fall. The cross, he killed Christ. And now at the end of the world, he's still trying to gather an army that's never going to win. And it's falling short. It's failure after failure after failure when coming into contact with what God's doing. And so it's symbolic of the beast's continuing failure to accomplish his purpose. It's the Trinity of imperfection. I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it. I really do. I think that that's a great way of looking at that number and saying it falls short of God. There's something about it, I think, that we will look at, like, if we're here, if we see the Antichrist, if we live through this and we find ourselves in that moment, that there's something about the Antichrist that's just not going to add up to God's people. Because what is it they tell you about a bank? And they bring in a teller and they put them in a room, and to become familiar with the money, they give them all the counterfeit money they can to get familiar with what counterfeit looks like? No. They hand them real money. And they want them to know the real money inside and out. They want them to know the real thing, because that way you can spot the counterfeit from a mile away. If you are fully invested in knowing what the real thing looks like, then the fake is simply that to you. It's a fake. It's obvious. And it's that's why you hear that there's false prophets in the world. There's preachers that you can tell that just aren't lining up with, and you can tell it from a mile away. Something clicks and you're like, that doesn't make sense according to God's word, because you are familiar with the real thing. You're familiar with God's word. You're familiar with the teachings that he has. And so what we see here is that in the view of the widely divergent and highly speculative, I don't know why I put big words like that in my notes, highly speculative solutions to the riddle, it seems best to possibly conclude that the specific meaning has been lost to us today. Honestly, I don't know that we can go back and figure out this number and say that's exactly what it meant. Now, if we can, it'll be revealed to us when the time comes. But I think we've become so obsessed with this that we've forgotten that there's a lot of other things that go with it. And so what I'm hoping tonight we can look at and say, I don't believe that number scares me like it used to. Like when I was a kid, it scared me to death. If I saw it, I mean, even now sometimes you're checking something out and it comes up 666, you hand them something new. Say, nope, ring that up too. I need a pack of gum. Because
if I see anything that's 666, I don't buy it.
And I mean, and that's the thing, is like, that's something that, you know, and just to clarify for you though, there are others who say the translation's wrong and it's 686 too. Just so you know. There's so many arguments about it. To me, that's a number. I think if 666 was something to be worried about, then John 666 wouldn't exist. They would have been 65, then 67, and everybody looked, where's 666? But it's a verse that really kind of leads you down the same path as the Antichrist, so it's kind of fun, because that's what Nick talked about yesterday. But what we see in this is this. Chapter 12 introduced us to the great dragons. It introduced us to the primary adversary of God, who was Satan. And then chapter 13 gives us the Antichrist and the false prophet. The same thing that we're dealing with. It's a trinity. It's that imperfect trinity. It's that trinity of evil, so to speak. So this chapter 13, we are given the two great forces that Satan will use to accomplish his evil plans. Now, whether it's actual beast or whether it's an idea or a metaphor or whatever it might be, that's not yet been revealed to us, I don't believe. But the stage is being set for the final encounter. And what is crucial at this point is to recognize the true nature of the struggle. The Lamb was victorious on the cross. I can't talk about this without saying that, because the full public acknowledgement of that victory awaits in a final moment.
Okay.
So the full public acknowledgement of the victory of Christ on the cross happens in the final moment of the world. And we've seen it in Revelation. We've seen it played out. And so here we are, believers live in the already but not yet tension of a battle won, but not quite over. The battle's been won. It's over. The war's over, but there's still battles to be fought. If that makes any sense whatsoever. It's clear as mud, I'm sure. Because what we're really looking at is that the timeline of God is not our timeline. The battle has already been won because God is sovereign and he won. He will not lose. So we're dealing with a battle that's going to be, or a war that'll be won, but battles that are being fought. And Satan's trying to win the little battles. Well, what are the little battles? Us. I'm a little battle. You're a little battle. We're all little battles. This is a battle he can win. He can try to win me over and pull me away from what God has already done for me. And he does that to everyone. Believers live in that already but not yet tension. And if we think about it in that way, victory's been achieved. The defeated enemy must still be permanently removed from the battlefield. And so as we look at the way this is going to play out and we get into chapter 14, eventually that will take place when the Messiah returns to establish his eternal rule on the earth. So we're through 13 chapters. Do we have questions, statements, answers, baptisms, rededications, any of that?